Els Brover is a former CIO of Toyota Australia and an independent board and executive IT advisor. He has a proven track record over three decades of building and leading world-class IT organisations, and his experience spans a range of roles and industries from startups to multinationals. In this episode of Crisis Talks, we talk about the changing IT landscape over the past few decades, the nature of cyber threats and how they have evolved, and the importance of building trust in your crisis teams when preparing for the worst case. We delve into one of his experiences as a CIO of a globally recognized brand that was targeted by an extremely complex cyber attack. His experience navigating the challenges of a cyber crisis is a must listen for business leaders, IT executives, and cyber teams in any organization. Els Brover, welcome along to Crisis Talks.
Thanks, Grant. Great to be with you.
Now, Els, it'd be great to give a bit of a background on your history in cyber industry in particular and some of your experiences without going into too much detail of the specific clients or otherwise whom you've worked with in the past. It'd be great to get a bit of an understanding of your history in this particular field.
Yeah, sure. So I've got a very conventional, I guess, IT background. Over 30 years now, I've been doing nothing but IT. Lots of different roles, lots of different industries, sectors, and organization sizes along the way. Most recently was CIO at Toyota Australia for over 8 years, which of course was an exciting journey for those of you who follow the automotive industry. Obviously, during that time, we withdrew from manufacturing in Australia, unfortunately, along with all of our competitors as well. So huge transformation, change inside the company. But in terms of IT in particular, was a time of huge growth, especially in digital, in analytics, and indeed in cyber as well. The IT team grew by more than threefold during my time as CIO. So lots of exciting challenges, lots of lessons learned. Since then, I left and decided to pursue an independent advisory course, which I've been doing for the last year and a half or so. And I'm enjoying helping clients with cyber in particular, and also with IT strategy and operating model challenges, as well as some mentoring for IT leaders.
No doubt some great experiences from that background. What were sort of the biggest changes you've seen, not specific to cyber, but let's start with general, with particularly in the automotive industry, what were some of the biggest changes that you saw happening around IT and digital transformation?
The IT challenges were really centered on digital during much of my time there. Digital disruption, I guess, came maybe late to the automotive industry compared to many other industries. But when it came, it really did come with a vengeance. When I started, we really didn't have a digital capability to speak of. It really wasn't a major point of investment for the industry at all. By the time I left, I think just my digital team was something like 150 people. So we really, plowed a lot of investment into digital, and it's really all about the customer experience. It's all about what customers want. Increasingly, our customers didn't just want the conventional physical experience of going into dealerships and talking to them about vehicles. They wanted to be able to do as much as possible online, up to and including actually buying cars, but obviously things like booking services as well, doing extensive research online, buying parts online. So it really became a whole new facet of the business, and that obviously drove a lot of that growth in IT that I talked about before.
Now, I remember reading or seeing an article recently from, I think, the CEO of Ford said that it's the first time now that they are properly investing in developing code in vehicles, whereas they'd use multiple different service providers. Is that the same sort of experience you saw back in that time?
Yeah, absolutely. So the other part of our transformation was really all about connected vehicles and putting a lot of that sophisticated technology into vehicles, whether it be for safety or for convenience or for entertainment features. So I think much like Ford and like other competitors, like Tesla indeed at the moment, we were spending very, very significantly in the technology that goes into the vehicles as well as websites and apps and so on.
And so with that change, no doubt that started to expose you to the understanding around how the risk in cyber presents to different organizations. How have you seen that change over the last 10, 15 years?
I mean, look, I think it's a cliche to say that cyber risks have grown, but of course they have over that time, and the cyber industry has grown massively as well. For me, it's kind of a tale of two halves, really. I think the good news is that most organizations now, I think, are much more aware of cyber risks than they were even a few short years ago. And increasingly, they have dedicated cyber resourcing. The bad news, unfortunately, that I see is there's still a lot of organizations I talk to that, I guess to put it bluntly, have their head in the sand. There's a lot of unrealism either on the risk or on their own level of resilience. So my concern, I guess, is that the cyber industry that I'm obviously a part of as well is overly focused on products, on silver bullets, on technical preventative controls, install our product and everything will be great. Usually, of course, cyber is not that simple. And my concern is that we're giving clients often a misleading sense of comfort that they're okay because they've invested in a particular suite of products. I also think that the industry doesn't at the moment do a great job of serving SME businesses. I guess in my advisory business now, I deal with a lot of smaller clients than the ones that I used to work for as an employee. And often I find there's just not enough offerings out there that are scaled appropriately to their size and that can help keep them secure.
Did you see that the focus on prevention often took away from the response capability investment?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, in fact, that's possibly the strongest point and most common point that I make to most clients that I talk to now is that, it's not that we want to discourage people from spending on prevention. Of course, it's a great thing. But what I see increasingly is that people spend most of their investment on prevention and then they stop there. And I guess my very strong experience is that you need to assume it will happen. Not be complacent enough to think that just because you might have done a decent job of prevention that you're going to be fine. You won't be fine. Sooner or later, a determined adversary will get in. And you need to be prepared for what you're going to do when that happens rather than hope that it won't.
But how difficult is that to explain to boards or explain to non-technical people that despite all this investment, the money we're giving over to you guys to invest in preventing these things from occurring, that it's still going to happen? How does that sort of balance come into the understanding of the risk for those non-technicals?
Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, look, cyber is obviously not the only kind of risk where, humans being what we are, we tend to assume, we tend to underestimate the probability. We tend to assume that it won't happen to us. It'll only happen to someone else. But I think cyber has some other, particular challenges. So for me, when I talk to boards or to leadership teams, there's probably three basic, statements that I boil it down to. One is assume you're a target and invest accordingly. The second is assume that you will be attacked and prepare accordingly. And the third is to treat cyber as an enterprise risk, not an IT issue. The problems that I see, the first one is what we just talked about. It's complacency, and I don't think that's unique to cyber. I think we do that with a lot of risks in our lives. But the second one, I think, is more interesting. As we said, there's too much focus, I think, on prevention and not enough resilience. And I think that's because of the lack of understanding of the real impact of a cyber attack. Not that I would, wish on anyone the experience of actually going through a bad one in order to learn. But I think it's typical that people look at that and think, oh, yeah, it would be horrible, it would be bad for our reputation, and we need to spend a bit of money. But they don't see how it feels to actually operate, for example, without IT systems at all for an extended period. They don't think that through. And I think the third point there about treating it as an enterprise risk, that's where I think most boards at the moment are particularly exposed. There's an aversion amongst directors to what's seen as a techie issue. But I firmly believe there's really no reason why a smart but non-tech-savvy director can't effectively oversee and govern their organization's cyber maturity, just as they do with other risks. A director's not expected to be a subject matter expert in every type of risk that the organization deals with. But for most other risks, I think most directors are quite comfortable getting into enough detail and asking the right questions of management. For cyber, there tends to be an assumption of, oh, the CIO will take care of that. We don't have to worry about that. So a lot of my advisory, to be honest, Grant, is spent in trying to dispel those myths.
Taking us into one of those sort of war rooms in the event of these sort of cyber events occurring, what were some of the things that you do recall from living through those sort of experiences?
Look, I unfortunately had an experience of a highly sophisticated and targeted attack in my career. It was one that was aimed at IP theft and espionage rather than the more common thing that we see these days of a smash and grab, extortion or damage oriented raid. And in many ways, that changes the nature of the response, and it probably makes it more difficult for most of us who just haven't previously been exposed to that level of attack. We were, I guess, quite fortunate in our case of detecting it early. We shut down systems before some irreparable damage was done. We put in enormous effort to cleanse and rebuild our environment. But we still had substantial business impact, and it was an absolutely searing experience for myself as an IT crisis leader, and obviously for everybody else involved in it. It's not something I'd wish on my worst enemies. But on the flip side, it gives you some incredibly valuable lived experience and, I guess, some passion for going out there and trying to help other people to not go through the same thing.
When these things kick off, can you give someone a bit of insight, everyone listening, a bit of insight into the sense of what you're dealing with is? Because we equate it to a bit like fighting in the dark in some moments, especially when you have to shut down systems in order to prevent further escalation. Can you explain in those early moments, those early hours, the sort of things that are going through your mind in those sort of roles?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the first thing that is probably kind of obvious when you think about it, but we don't really expect, is that you don't know what you're dealing with, exactly what you described. You're really fighting in the dark for a lot of the time. In retrospect, things always look easier and more obvious, but at the time, information is being drip-fed to you. Often it's misleading, it's contradictory, it's unclear, it's incomplete. And yet you've got to make some decisions. You've got to take some action based on your best intuition, your best understanding of the situation. Look, in our particular case, I guess we detected some suspicious activity fairly early. It didn't take very long to realize that we were dealing with a highly sophisticated adversary with an extensive toolkit of exploits who had essentially free reign of our systems. So that means it's not enough to just stop one means of entry that you find, because these people have many more means of entry. And so you've got to be a lot more nuanced in your response. And the advice that we took, and the usual advice in these sort of situations, is actually to lay low, to not respond immediately, but to watch and learn on what they're doing, how they're doing it before you react. Again, it sounds easy. It's actually incredibly difficult to do emotionally when you're responsible for your company's IT environment, and yet you're sitting there watching somebody going through your property that you're responsible for, and you're not doing anything about it. You're not stopping them, but it is the right thing to do. And we did that until we had to take the decision to shut everything down once we saw that our attackers were about to access some very sensitive information. And that decision is one that you often need to make very quickly without a great deal of considered thought and assessment. And yet, obviously, it has a massive impact on the business. You're essentially shutting your business down. And you don't know at that point how long you're shutting it down for. You can't tell anyone whether it's for a few hours, a few days, a few weeks, a few months. But you need to do it. And then, of course, you activate your response team. So we had an IT response team, which took over a boardroom and became a 24/7 den filled with Red Bull cans and pizza boxes.
And coffee.
But I think more importantly, we activated an organization-wide crisis team. Essentially, the entire executive team of the organization with multiple daily stand-ups to make decisions. And I think that's a really, really critical part of the response.
Did you run a separate IT bridge versus as a technical bridge versus then the crisis response?
Yeah. And I think you do need to keep them separate. The IT people are obviously busy 24/7 cleansing, checking, rebuilding from the ground up, in many cases, some substantial infrastructure. You're essentially compressing into a few hours or a few days projects that would normally be carefully planned and executed and tested over the course of a few months. Those people, you don't want to be distracting them with every conversation about prioritization and which system should come first and which one should come next and what the business impact is and so on. So for us, it was very much the best thing was to separate those two things completely, protect the IT team, give them clear direction and priorities and let them get on with the work they needed to do, but support the business decisions, which really mostly have nothing to do with IT at the end of the day, about how we keep running critical business processes when there are no systems. You know, those are two separate conversations, I mean.
Do you have any work that you've done around prioritization of that restoration? Because we see that now as being a big challenge where, particularly if organizations haven't got that priority established with an all-out outage at once, the capacity to restore in a set order becomes quite limited and it's restricted to a few key people generally only. So have you seen that that's been that investment in that prioritization of re-establishment or restoration?
Yeah, definitely. And I guess one of the lessons learned for me about that is that how carefully you really need to think about that in advance. I think it's all too easy in a typical organization. I think most IT divisions do already have a sense of prioritization. There's big ticket expensive systems like ERP, financial, supply chain, and so on that we invest a lot in the support. We make sure they're up 24/7, they're fully patched, etc. But when you're actually in the middle of a complete IT outage for an extended period, sometimes the systems that you thought were the most critical are actually not the most critical, because there are ways usually of continuing to run some key business processes manually. It's not great. It's painful. It's inefficient. It's horrible. But there are ways usually of continuing to run a lot of those processes on pen and paper, essentially. But what you often find is that sometimes it's some minor systems, something sitting off in a corner that maybe you don't really think about very much, that actually has no fallback at all, that has no viable business continuity plan because it's so minor that no one's really thought about it. And those are the ones that really hurt you. So I'd encourage people, when you're doing that prioritization, really think through ruthlessly and imagine that situation of nothing working. So rather than asking the business the questions of what are the important systems to you and how well would you like them supported, because often you get answers like, oh, our website, you know, custom presence, reputation, brochures, etc. But ask the question of, let's imagine everything is down. What are you going to do for the next few weeks? What are those things you absolutely cannot do without? And how are we going to mitigate that? Which I think is, it's a different question. It can lead to some different answers.
It is, yeah. And we often talk about in terms of maximum tolerable outage. So 4 hours, 12 hours, 24, 48, those sort of timeframes get thrown around. But they don't factor that being out for the extended period of time and the manual workaround to handle those whilst they're down. So I think it's a really good insight. What about playbooks? I mean, we talk a lot about playbooks, or we hear a lot about playbooks when we're doing some of our work. How true to form was the playbook to the situations you've been involved in?
Playbooks are great. I definitely encourage people to plan as much as possible, but expect that in a real life crisis, parts of that playbook are going to change. They're going to go out the window. I think perhaps like with many other areas of life, perhaps like military operations, things don't always go the way you would have liked them to have gone. So in our case, for example, we lacked experience with responding to that level of attack. We weren't prepared for quite that level of sophistication. And in fact, even local industry experts, advisors, large IT firms, we found didn't have the right level of expertise. And so it was very difficult to have a playbook for that. And that meant, unfortunately, we were learning on the job. We were learning as we were going. Now, in that case, we took the decision to bring in some overseas expertise with specific experience dealing with this adversary. If we had not done that, we would have made some incorrect and perhaps very damaging decisions. The broader crisis response team, I think, was critical, as I said before. And the key thing about that, I think, in terms of playbooks is that business continuity planning. There is a tendency, I think, at the beginning, and we frankly experienced that at the beginning of our crisis as well, to just point fingers at the IT team or the IT leader and essentially ask the adult version of, are we there yet? Are we there yet? That's obviously not helpful in most cases. The IT team is already working as hard as it possibly can without any rest or any sleep to get us there. The better question, of course, is what are we going to do in the meantime? Let's assume that this is out for a period of extended period of weeks. If it's not, then great, we'll have some good news. But let's plan into the worst case. What are we going to do to run our key business processes? How are we going to maintain supply to our customers? How are we going to pay our suppliers? How are we going to pay our staff and so on? So I think I'd encourage if people are going to work on a playbook, focus on that side more than on the technology side. Often we have great IT playbooks for disaster recovery and how to cut over to a backup system and so on. But we tend to not be so strong on that business continuity side.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I've seen also where employees are often the important ones that are missed out of that whole loop of what's going to happen around stakeholders and customers and inquiry management, all those sort of issues. How quickly was that time between, you know, your initial sort of observation of the threat actor, that shutdown component, but then the sort of stakeholder inquiries starting to really emerge? How quickly was that sort of time frame? Did you have a bit of time to prepare teams for that, or was it really pretty quite sudden once you did shut down to have that inquiries coming through?
It was quite sudden, to be honest. I think because of the nature of what was happening to us, we had to make a shutdown decision, you know, essentially with minutes to spare or seconds to spare, so that there wasn't a lot of time to plan ahead to make that an orderly shutdown. We pretty quickly regrouped and came up with some good plans after that. And I guess when I look back in retrospect, we probably took us about 8 days to restore our most critical business systems. But it felt far, far longer than that. You know, those 8 days felt like an age, but actually that's pretty fast, I think, in the scheme of things. But of course, that was just a small number of the really critical systems out of several hundred. That was, you know, a dozen or something. Restoring everything took months, and essentially the whole of the following year, I guess you could say, the best part of IT resources were really essentially diverted towards recovery, restoration, and improvement, rather than previously planned activities. So that's a huge impact.
Your reassurance during those sort of detailed changes is often a real challenge, because you've got customers and other people asking, well, can I trust you to recommence? How did you, you know, build that reassurance and assure those customers that it was going to be safe to start or recommence operations with you or recommence connections with you?
I think the first thing that I think we did well was we took a really strong safety first approach to it. So we held our ground very strongly, sometimes in the face of considerable pressure to restart specific systems or interfaces until we were absolutely sure that it was safe. And in retrospect, of course, that was the right thing to do. But at the time, it's very easy to succumb to a bit of pressure and, oh, you know, how bad can this be? If I just restart this one thing, it shouldn't be too bad. I think the second thing was, in terms of that prioritization that we touched on before, we adopted, a very values-based approach to prioritization, so that it was really focusing on our customers before our staff. So that meant even if we were essentially subjecting our own staff for a period of time for some heavy inconvenience and some really inefficient processes for running our business manually, but in the eyes of the customer, we wanted things to be right as quickly as possible. Obviously, thinking that sort of stuff through in advance, and we talked about that business continuity planning, is really helpful, because when you're in the heat of battle, making those sort of decisions can be tough, and it can be easy to succumb to whoever has the louder and more persuasive voice in the room. Whereas if you've thought it through beforehand and agreed, of course, it makes it a bit easier. So I think to answer your question in terms of stakeholders, yeah, we were able to demonstrate that we'd taken some very, very strong steps in terms of strengthening cyber controls, monitoring, and so on. But we also were able to implement some immediate strengthening of cyber controls. So before we turned anything back on, we already lifted our level of preventative controls and monitoring significantly. But of course, that wasn't enough. And after recovery, we then embarked on a huge multi-year cyber resilience improvement program, really leveraging a lot of those lessons that we'd learned.
Did you have any third-party assurance as well as part of that process?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, so we had some external experts coming in as well to assure. And of course, usually you've got a cyber insurer involved in these things as well. So there's another level of, I guess, independent vetting there. But I'll say, so sometimes these things, the buck does stop with somebody in an organization. And despite all the advice, internal or external, somebody actually has to make the decision at the end of the day that it's okay to recommence, to turn things back on. And a lot of that, I think, comes down to, well, your experience, but also your intuition about how confident you are in everything you're being told.
What were some of the biggest lessons for you coming out of that response?
Where do we start? I've got heaps of them. In terms of prevention, I guess, starting at that end of the scale, as I said before, don't assume that you're not a target. I think one of the key lessons we learned was that we were more of an interesting target for a more sophisticated adversary than we'd ever thought we were. And I think that lesson applies to many organizations that I've talked to as well. Don't assume that your controls are going to stop a determined adversary. I think having a strong cyber leader who's not only strong in terms of cyber domain knowledge, but is a great communicator and is empowered within the organization to make a difference. I think the issue of sensitive data, something, of course, we've seen in lots of recent attacks. I like to tell boards to think of their sensitive data as toxic waste. It's very fashionable at the moment to think of it as a great asset, and of course it is. You can leverage it for all sorts of business benefit, but actually, of course, when you have an attack, it's a massive liability. And even if you don't know in the early days of an attack whether that data has been compromised, whether it's going to be misused or not, you have to assume the worst. And that's the time when you look back and think, why did we capture that piece of data and keep it? Did we really need to know Grant's date of birth and driver's license number? Probably not. So I encourage people, think of that in advance, treat it as toxic waste. Don't capture it if you don't absolutely have to. And if you do have to, then protect it with a ring of steel.
Great metaphor for it, actually, because you're right. I think the Attorney General said that it should be treated as a liability versus an asset. But I don't see too many boards having that on a liability schedule or an asset schedule on their balance sheet.
No, quite right. And I don't see enough boards simply asking, and again, this comes back to the earlier point about it doesn't have to be techie. This is not a techie question, but I want to see boards asking management, tell me what data we are keeping about our customers and our employees, and why are we keeping it? What are we doing with it? It's a simple question, and I find often when you ask that in organizations, you get the initial glib answer of, no, we don't have anything sensitive, we're fine. When you dig a little deeper, you get, yes, we're keeping credit card numbers unencrypted, and we're keeping driver's license numbers and dates of birth and addresses, and maybe we don't really have to. So yeah, ask those questions and be ruthless about, do you really need it? And I guess the other key thing for me there is focus on culture, not just technology. We talked before about our industry is full of, you know, technology solutions to problems, and that's natural because that's easier to sell. But actually, most organizations I talk to, the biggest bang for buck in terms of improving their cyber maturity is about culture. It's about role modeling by senior leaders. It's about awareness and training and so on, more than about the next technical control.
I think that one's a difficult one because we see it at the other end where we're sometimes brought in to run some exercises where we're really not challenging. Those engagements are often not the best for us because we're not able to demonstrate to them the reality of a situation you're going through in a cyber event. So how difficult, or what would be your advice to CIOs, CTOs, CISOs, and even CEOs that are investing in this training but not taking it to the proper nth degree?
I think there's a couple of lessons that I learned about training. One is that it's got to be engaging. It's kind of obvious, but there's a lot of corporate compliance training now that we make mandatory for employees that's just really, really boring. And people will click through next, but they won't absorb it. One thing we did well, I think, in the aftermath of the incident I talked about was find training that was really engaging. It was fun. It was still educational. You know, every little episode was a video and it was done as kind of a funny skit, and people look forward to the next weekly installment of what's going to happen next and so on. It had humor in it, but in every one there was a punchy message out of it, and people would tend to absorb that and remember it better. I think the other thing with it is role modeling. I just mentioned before, there's no use having a mandatory wonderful cyber awareness program in the organization if everybody knows that the CEO or the chair of the board or somebody else senior and influential has got the worst cyber hygiene in the company and, you know, gets his or her assistant to actually click through the training for them, never changes their password, writes it on sticky note, all that kind of stuff. Those messages totally dilute whatever great work the CISO or the CIO might be doing in terms of awareness. So I think it's critical to get your leaders on board as active role models. And again, they don't have to be tech savvy. They don't have to stand up and talk about all of the great cyber hygiene measures that they've come up with. All they have to do is stand up and reinforce the message that the CISO or the CIO is giving about how it's important and how they're personally taking action. And that makes a huge difference, I think.
We see a lot of investment in those plans, the playbooks and the like, with not balancing that with the investment in the cyber crisis or even just general crisis preparedness. Having lived through that now, how important was that for you?
Yeah, it's incredibly important. I think there's so many lessons you learn, unfortunately, going through a real-life crisis that are really, really hard to learn in advance, in a textbook. If we, look at emotions, for example, I learned a huge amount, some good, some not so good, about the people that I worked with, that I've been working with for years, whether it's your staff and your team, whether it's your board, your stakeholders, your suppliers, and so on. Because in a crisis, of course, people's emotions tend to be heightened. People's true natures tend to come out. And that can lead to some interesting behaviors, not just in others, but of course in yourself as well. You get to learn something about yourself and how you respond in a crisis, what you do well, what you don't do so well. I think the more of that you can kind of predict in advance and be ready for, the better off you're going to be. I certainly saw some examples of there was great examples of people that were not in a leadership position but stepped up in a crisis and took leadership, demonstrated natural leadership skills that maybe we wouldn't otherwise have seen in them. I also saw the other one. I saw people who were paid to be in leadership positions and make decisions and who fell to pieces, at least for a while, during the crisis and weren't able to be effective. You see the egos come out. You see people treating it as a political situation, making somebody look good, making somebody look bad, and so on. You see, as I talked about before, the "are we there yet" kind of responses from people that maybe aren't terribly helpful, or do you know what impact you're causing me? So you've got to be prepared, I think, emotionally as a leader for all of that. And it's incredibly difficult, obviously, to deal with all of that emotion and the stakeholders and the pressures and the personal sense of what the organization is going through and that you're responsible for it in some way, while also with your own team as much as possible, maintaining the calm, the balance, the confidence. It's really difficult, of course, to maintain the clarity and the calm when they're in your own head. It's not feeling so clear and so calm at all. But it's really, really important because obviously in a crisis, your people will look to you for a sense of confidence of we are going to get through this. We may not know every step yet and exactly how, but we will get through this. And here's the next step that we need to take.
And how important was any of that leadership training that you had done before? Were you able to draw down on any of those other experiences you've had in order to lead through those critical moments?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly leadership, even in normal non-crisis situations, of course, it often involves a lot of that, dealing with emotions and balancing multiple competing issues at the same time, prioritizing and so on. Of course, all of those things get heightened in a crisis, maybe to a degree that you've never experienced before in your career. But I think you're right, you still lean on those fundamental skills. I think probably the key one for me, I found, was that thing we always talk about with leaders of being able to stand on the balcony while also being in the dance. I think it's particularly important in a crisis for the leader to be able to do a bit of both, to be able to be in the war room with the IT team, understanding what's going on, supporting them, but also to be able to zoom back out and see the bigger context. Because often in those sort of situations, especially in IT, we tend to get tunnel vision. We tend to get focused on the next thing. And the guys are saying, in half an hour, I'm going to get this server recovered. Just give me a chance to do that. And you can often just hours or days can go past without stepping back and thinking, but is this actually the right thing to be doing? Is this the next best priority for the organization as a whole? So I think you've got to have that ability to zoom back out of that detail that's all consuming and that you're really passionate about and be able to say, is my team working on the right priority right now? Am I giving them the right support? What else can I do to unblock whatever bottlenecks they may be facing?
Having gone through one of these big events yourself now, what is one thing that you would ideally like to have gone back and done beforehand?
So many things.
You only get one.
All right. I think the planning for what you're going to do when the crisis happens is the biggest thing that I would do. And again, I don't mean that in terms of technical steps. I mean that in terms of the leadership side, the business continuity, and even that emotional and human side I talked about before. Things like rest and refresh. We didn't think of that beforehand. We didn't think, what are we going to do if we have a crisis that involves constant 24/7 work for an extended time? And in retrospect, we should have done that. It's a basic thing. And of course, in the heat of it, you don't think of that. People stay back. They want to do the best for the organization. And after a while, you realize that these guys haven't slept for 48 hours and they're not functioning anymore. And you've got to send them home and you've got to build a roster and you've got to have somebody appointed to bring the pizzas and the Red Bulls and the coffees and make sure people are going to sleep at a reasonable time and so on. So, yeah, my one lesson would be plan for that stuff in advance.
How long did it take you in the end? You mentioned it was about 8 days initially, but then there was a bit more of an extended time post. End to end, what was the sort of broad timeframes for the benefit of the audience?
I guess it depends where you exactly define the end, but probably to restore every one of the 300 plus systems to, you know, full working condition and no longer be in any kind of crisis mode was probably several months. But as I say, after that, then there was an enormous focus on uplifting cyber maturity and resilience, and that took years.
Yeah, we often talk around about that 18-month sort of recovery time frame from any sort of broad incidents, any big ones that have an organizational impact, regardless of cause, both the emotional, the welfare, the physical restoration, the physical recovery. They take a long time to actually get over, as well as the reputational impact, obviously, as well.
Yeah, and then I think if you think about the emotional impact on the key people who are involved, I think that lasts for years. It doesn't go away.
Yeah, and I think that's that challenge again, because you're rebuilding trust in the systems and trust in the processes that you've established as well post these events, which, like you said, requires that additional effort to reassure. And that recovery piece, is that often something that's missed in your view on preparation? So if you talk about those plans, do you think that the overall recovery piece is often underestimated?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's natural that after a significant cyber incident, there's going to be a great deal of interest within the organization at senior levels on how we can improve and avoid it again. And yeah, that's, as the old Winston Churchill saying, there's never waste a crisis. And definitely encourage people to, you know, in that unfortunate situation, to not waste the crisis, because you may never get that level of interest and investment in cyber again. But I guess one of my learnings looking at other companies I've been involved in has been that corporate memories are pretty short. And sometimes that initial rush of blood and investment, it's great, but a year or two later, talk to CIOs who have boards asking them, why are we still spending money on cyber if we haven't had an attack for a few years? So, I'd advise sort of cyber leaders to not waste the crisis and move fast, and establish an ongoing governance and awareness activity, because we all know cyber is not a one-off set and forget investment. You've got to keep doing it. So use that opportunity to keep educating and keep driving that awareness regularly.
What are you sort of seeing as the sort of next horizon now? We've had a lot of the product sort of focused preventative sort of measures. We've had a spate of events over the last few years, which has raised the awareness around crisis preparedness generally. What do you think is going to be the next horizon for preparedness and prevention within the industry?
I'm hoping that it's going to be some of those things that I've just been advocating for, and in particular that we're going to see a heightened level of involvement by boards and leadership teams in really driving that business and leadership preparedness side for cyber. I guess in my fondest dreams, I'd love to see every organization I go into having that really strong awareness of cyber at every level of the organization, and a sense of accountability that this is not just the CIO's problem. It's not just an IT issue. It's just another business risk, like all the other ones that we deal with at the board, that has to be properly managed, and that we have to set an appropriate risk reward appetite for.
I think that's a really good place to finish there. Thanks, Alice. So I think today's been a really good opportunity to get some great insights from you on the experiences that people go through when they're having to lead through these big cyber events. So I really appreciate you taking the time to join us on Crisis Talks today. Thank you.
Thanks for your time, Grant.
Thanks for listening to Alice Brover and his experience leading through cyber crisis. In the next episode of Crisis Talks, we'll be talking about how to handle a notifiable data breach. What are the considerations? How do you classify and categorize your data whilst confronted by a threat actor? How do you work through the challenges of notifying those different stakeholders that might be affected? And how do you handle the reputational impact to your organization?